Well, good morning, everyone. It's nice to see so many faces, familiar and new. I am going to talk about clinging today. Tiweri started us off earlier in the month with clinging and introduced it, so I'm going to continue. And we usually start with a story or poem. We've been reading a lot of poems from the book, The First Free Women, Poems of the Early Buddhist Nuns, and I'm going to continue with that. In fact, I chose this poem earlier this week, and I thought, I read every poem in the book, and I thought, oh, this is perfect. And then Monday night, Tiweri read the same poem. So for some of you, this will be the second hearing of this, but I definitely think it's worth two readings. So it's this book, several people have asked about this book, and it's a new translation of the Theragata, which is the story of the first Buddhist nuns of who lived in the Buddhist time. And it tells, it's just little short poems, some very story poems, where they describe their path to Nibbana. So the one I'm going to read is called The Goldsmith's Daughter, and it goes like this. Subha, the goldsmith's daughter. They all told me the same thing. There's only one way to be truly safe. Get as much as you can and hold on tight. We don't take greed seriously enough. I grew up in a house made of gold, so I ought to know. You see what it does to people, slowly, over time. It changes them. It takes over. You find yourself saying, I'll learn to be generous. I'll give it all away. But first, I just need a little bit more. Stop lying to yourself. See a clenched fist for what it is. Not tomorrow, not in 20 years, now. I am Subha, the goldsmith's daughter, eating whatever is offered, sleeping wherever I can. This is what freedom looks like, not a bucket of coins buried out back. Just like you, I spent a long time going back and forth, but eventually, I had to stand up and say it out loud. I will not be owned. So several things stood out to me in this poem. Subha says we don't take greed seriously enough. She says, see a clenched fist for what it is. She says, eventually, I had to stand up and say it out loud. I will not be owned. The Buddha tells us that we must start with acknowledging suffering. That's the first noble truth. He says our experience will be characterized by impermanence, which is anicca in Pali, unsatisfactoriness, which is dukkha in Pali, and no self, anatta in Pali. This is going to cause us suffering. These are the three characteristics of all experience. Even though we may not be aware of that, these qualities do not promote notions of comfort in us. We would prefer a more comforting, more beautiful, more enchanting image of the way things are. It's likely that our mind and our culture will distort the truth of the way things are so that we sense no change in the changing, so that we sense pleasure in suffering, so that we assume self where there is no self, and finally, that we sense the unlovely as lovely. In the Vipalasa Sutta, which describes the four distortions of perception, the translator says about these distortions of perception, he uses an image. And the image, I think, is powerful. He says, if you take the word vipalasa apart in Pali, you get the image of the mind taking something up, turning it around, and throwing it back down. It's a distortion of reality by the perceptual and cognitive apparatus of the brain. Let's take gold as an example, the perception of gold. It's sturdy, it's shiny and lovely, and it can buy many sensory pleasures and comforts for us. But Subha, the goldsmith's daughter, grew up in a house of gold, and she saw how something that is lovely, that appears lovely and prized, can do a number on the psyche of the human being. It can twist things around, turn things upside down, and instead of the human being owning or being in control of many wonderful things that gold can purchase, those things can actually come to own that human being. We can substitute gold for lots of things we value, both material objects and mind objects. For example, our bodies, our houses, our cars, our jobs, our accomplishments, power, privilege, pride, opinions, our children's accomplishments, our partner's accomplishments. When we put my in front of these things, we can be on the lookout for clinging. So, two Sundays ago, Tweary introduced us to clinging, the ninth link of the cycle of dependent origination, which so often follows close on the heels of craving, the eighth link. The Buddha identifies craving as the cause of suffering, and this morning I'm going to talk about some of the qualities that intensify and propel craving into clinging, and how mindfulness of these qualities can help us release that grip. In dependent origination, first there's ignorance and delusion. We're not consciously aware of what is really real. We aren't aware of the three characteristics of all experience. And there is a dual reality that human beings need to come to understand, the relative and the absolute. We need to live with an awareness of both and the difference between them. The absolute reality is an ungraspable field of flux. That's Gregory Kramer's definition. But to survive in this world, we must first develop a sense of ourself. We have to have a working ego with a name, and we need forms and concepts which make the world navigable and enable us and the rest of our society, species, to survive. We have to be able to organize the formless with forms and then be able to let go of the forms, understanding that they are not absolute. They are convenient and useful, but we need to be able to see through them. An Indian teacher, whom I have quoted before, using the same quote, but it seemed appropriate, says that the real world is beyond our thoughts and ideas. We see it through the net of our desires. To see the universe as it really is, you must step beyond the net. It's not hard to do because the net is full of holes. It's not either or, it is both and. We are human and limited, and we are something else, a lot more mysterious. So we have to live with our net. We're human and we're going to have that net, but lucky for us, it's full of holes, so it's not impermeable. As Tweary has already said, it's very human to desire, and it's human to cling, and we all do this. But not all desire progresses to clinging and causes suffering. It's possible to have a wholesome relationship to desire. The sense doors naturally move toward what is pleasant to them and away from what is unpleasant to them. We don't control this. it's easy to see that different conditions out of our control cause us to develop different preferences. I might like this and I don't like that, but you might like that and not like something else that I like. And this, we see this all the time in food, music, clothing, styles, entertainment, and a host of other experiences. We have these different preferences. The problem is when we identify with them, when we take possession of them, demand that they mean something more, then we get in trouble. As the Buddha said to Bahia, who was asking him how he could, he was a wise person as it was, but he went to the Buddha to find his way to Nibbana quickly because he felt a strong urgency. But the instructions that the Buddha gave him were, whenever you see a form, let there be just the seeing. Whenever you hear a sound, let there be just the hearing. And when a thought arises, let it be just a natural, phenomenon rising in the mind. When it's like this, there will be no self, no I. And that's the end of dukkha. So we need to be aware of when we are adding. We will be adding something to the bare sensory contact because we're human. And maybe an arahant can just hear and add nothing. But you and me, we are going to be adding something, but it's important to be able to see what we're adding and to be aware of it so we have a relationship and can develop a, a healthy relationship with it. And that can be the difference between desire in a healthy form and clinging in an unhealthy form. Another healthy, wholesome kind of desire is aspiration. When this is a kind of desire, for example, when we aspire to act in accordance with one of the paramis, such as being truthful or patient, it's a way of guiding our efforts toward a wholesome goal. You know, we want to be happy. We want to be non-harmful. That's an aspiration, and that's a healthy aspiration. So not all wanting leads us down the path to clinging and to dukkha. We can develop healthy relationships to this natural behavior. I think a good example of a healthy relationship to wanting and to having preferences can be seen in an example I read about the Dalai Lama many years ago. Actually 20 years ago, and I've forgotten a lot of the specifics, but essentially what happened is the Dalai Lama was at a reception where a choice of desserts was being served, and following the guidelines for monks, he couldn't go up and get one of those desserts himself, and he couldn't request a specific dessert. The rule was that he would take what was offered. So the narrator of this story was seated next to him. And when the Dalai Lama was served, let's say he was served a slice of cake, he graciously thanked the server, and then he smiled and said under his breath, "I really wanted the pie." That was it. That was the end of the story. I loved the story because I saw that it's human, even for someone like the Dalai Lama, whom I revere as a very, deeply spiritual person, to have preferences and to want something other than what is offered. But his response when seeing this in himself was amusement, recognition of his humanity, not a reaction like judgment or blame, which is where I often land. Someone else could have reacted by setting in motion a proliferation of thoughts, a papancha of story, as it's called in Pali. I never get what I want. Why do I have to accept what is offered? That server knew I really wanted the pie and served me the cake on purpose. This kind of reaction would be an example of seeing the world through the net of our desires. And I recognize that that often happens to me. The net is made up of all those narratives and projections that we create. And often we are the star of those projections and those narratives, or the victim or the hero. The other example I have is not as elegant as the Dalai Lama's. It's my own example. And it is an example of more of a struggle with clinging. And it's pretty recent. So some of you will have, I think, maybe some connection to this. I didn't realize that I was clinging to fresh air. I knew that I was grateful to live in the Northwest by the water where the air pollution was minimal. I knew that since spring during this pandemic, which has kept me at home a lot, that every morning I couldn't wait to get out to my back porch with my coffee and sit and look out at my garden, listen to the birds, watch them at the bird feeder or in the bird bath, look out at the horizon. I spent a lot of time looking at the sky this year, this summer and spring, and really seeing cloud formations and seeing so often, oh, this is so beautiful. It was very comforting, has been very comforting. And I really didn't think that was an extravagant pleasure. I actually thought it was pretty wholesome. But then it was taken away from me when the smoke arrived. At first, I was fairly equanimous. I closed my windows and looked out. I was grateful I had a house to be in and windows to close. But by the third day, I began to panic. I was claustrophobic and thoughts started proliferating. This is never going to end. The air is poison. What will happen to the birds? I woke up in the night and I couldn't go back to sleep. The sky was too close, like a heavy blanket, and I was going to be smothered. I longed for this clear blue sky when everything would be okay again. If only. I was aware that I was craving that things be different, that I was clinging to the time before the smoke came. It was hard to accept. This is the way it is right now. I knew, I've said that many times, but it was really hard to just say, this is the way it is right now, because it did not feel good. And it was actually really scary to me. I did know from practice that it would be a good idea to drop the story as much as I could when it came up, to let go of those words, that the words just kind of kept things going and got me in deeper, contributed to my fear, increased my body sensations of contraction. It was like a vicious cycle, because then the more I was afraid, the more my body tightened, the more my body tightened, the more I was afraid. It didn't help me feeling, I was feeling like I couldn't really breathe, and that didn't help. But I knew from practice, staying in the body and sensing that right now in this present moment, I was actually breathing. And that helped me relax. And if I could just stay in my body and focus on my breathing and realize I was breathing, it helped me relax. I could feel the pull of the wish for the fresh air. You know, like I just, when is it going to come back? Oh, I remember it. And the fact that I was really grateful for it before this time didn't seem to help any when I didn't have it, because I really wanted it. And I felt a strong push of aversion to the smoke that I felt was trapping me. And then I would come back to the present as much as I can and say to myself, right now I can breathe in and out. I could see that. So that's one of the ways I worked with the suffering of my clinging. Trying a lot to let go of the urge to proliferate a story and trying to stay present and in my body. But I was working on this talk on clinging and the distortions. So I was thinking of that too. I was thinking about the three characteristics: impermanence and satisfactoriness, no self, and the four distortions, which Twori had talked about at the first beginning of the month. I was thinking about the smoke in relation to these three characteristics and the four distortions. I was thinking of the big picture. And I thought, you know, I'm not really the star of this movie, even though I feel like I'm at the center of it. It's happening. I feel like it's happening to me, and I would like a happy ending. I would like to have this be the last time fires went on a rampage across the West, killed people, destroyed homes and businesses, and caused devastation to wildlife, as well as causing smoke here in Seattle, which made me feel claustrophobic. But it didn't seem like this was what was called for. By that, I mean the story with the happy ending. It seemed like that would be a distortion of reality. It would be sensing the unlovely as lovely. I thought of the five recollections, which we've talked about before, and which the Buddha taught was a way to practice with inevitable loss. I thought of the specific recollection: all that is dear to me and everyone I love are of a nature to change. There is no way to escape being separated from them. And I thought of the chant, Anicca Vata Sankhara, which is often chanted at retreats at the end of the day. This chant in the suttas was said to be recited by Sakka, the king of the Devas, just after the passing away of the Buddha. The English translation goes like this: all conditioned things are impermanent. Their nature is to arise and pass away. To live in harmony with this truth brings the highest happiness. Subha says, I am Subha, the goldsmith's daughter. Just like you, I spent a long time going back and forth, and I saw myself going back and forth. The happy ending, which was, and there was blue sky happily ever after, and all conditioned things are impermanent. Their nature is to arise and pass away. I have a lot to still learn about clinging. And I'm going to close with this quote, which is an aspiration of mine. An aspiration of the way I would like to relate to some of the things I cling to. It's a quote from Kate Johnson, and it's a part of some instructions on the Brahmavihara that was given at a month-long retreat. And she says, equanimity is the heart of love that is able to hold the truth of suffering, the truth of change, the unfathomable workings of karma, and able to be with the fact that we're not able to control circumstances all the time. It's the heart that's able to hold all of these things and to love anyway. Thank you.